I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. My guest now has written an engrossing book that challenges long-held assumptions about our human morality. Frans de Waal has written a stimulating, challenging, and fascinating book. In The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society, we learn that humans are not inherently selfish and competitive. We are hardwired for empathy. And that the events of recent years, the economic meltdown, Hurricane Katrina, and the election of Barack Obama, somehow signals perhaps a return to those immutable aspects of human society: trust, compassion, generosity, solidarity, and justice. Frans de Waal is a noted primatologist, professor of psychology, and director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Center at Emory University in Atlanta. He is a prize-winning and best-selling author. Time selected him one of the world's 100 most influential people. The book is published in this country by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program in Toronto this day, Frans de Waal. Good morning, Professor de Waal.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. You're a primatologist. I'd appreciate if you give me a lesson on primates. They are the species that are that most resemble us, that most resemble humans, are they?
Oh, it's even better. We are primates. We belong to the primate order. That's why they're called primates, the first among animals by Linnaeus long ago. And so primates, they have frontal vision, they have hands. They in our case, we have no tail, but most of the primates have tails. We belong to a special group that is tailless, which are the apes and the humans. So apes are very different from monkeys. Monkeys have tails and are smaller. So there are about 200 species, and everything is primate that is related to you. And so, for example, the recent discovery of Ardipithecus that you may have heard just today, a human ancestor, is also a primate. All of that is primates.
So I guess I was referring to chimpanzees, which you study. How close are they? I mean, in terms of percentages, what's the difference between us and them?
Very, very small. So they are apes. Chimpanzees' DNA is 98.5% identical to our DNA. That doesn't mean that we are exactly like a chimp, because we have some differences, and they are interesting. But they're extremely close to us. So the distance, the genetic distance between a human and a chimp is like between a horse and a zebra. It's very small.
Now, am I pronouncing this right? Bonobos?
Bonobos are also our close relatives. So chimps and bonobos are the two closest to us of living primates, and they are equally close to us. Bonobos are much gentler species. They have sex instead of war, so to speak. So they resolve their issues more easily than chimpanzees, who sometimes kill each other. And for bonobos, there's no evidence yet that they ever kill each other.
Now, studying them gives us insights into us. How?
Well, because if we study other primates and ourselves, then we can compare, and maybe we can, for example, arrive at where we come from, and what kind of characteristics do we have in common, what kind of characteristics are different from between us and them. And one obvious difference is that we have language, and that we have a larger brain, so we can accomplish more mentally than a chimpanzee or a bonobo. But in the basic emotions and social life, so to speak, our social psychology is basically a primate social psychology.
Is there a difference between primates that are captive as opposed to ones that are wild?
Yeah, there's some obvious differences. Primates in captivity, they cannot get away from each other, and so it's important that they have space, but you can never give them the space they have in the field. And they don't need to look for them for their food, because their food is given to them. They live longer. So, for example, chimpanzees, they live in captivity up to 60 years sometimes, but in the wild, more like 45. So they live longer, they have a healthier life, and they have an easier life. And as a result, their social life intensifies. And so they spend time, more time, dealing with each other and grooming each other and things like that.
In terms of your scholarship, do you notice that there's a great difference between studying those in the wild and those that are captive?
the sort of issues that I'm interested on are basic social issues, and they are very similar between chimpanzees in captivity and in the field. So, for example, I'm interested in reconciliation. With chimpanzees, they kiss and embrace each other after a fight, which they do in the field also. I'm interested in power politics. Chimpanzees form coalitions to achieve powerful positions, which they do also in the field. I'm interested in empathy, and that's what the book is about, is that how do they react to the emotions of somebody else? Do they respond to these emotions? Do they help each other under particular conditions? And those things have also been observed in the field. So the basic social dynamics of the animals don't necessarily change. The basic psychology doesn't necessarily, just as it doesn't change between humans who live in a rural site or in the countryside, or humans who live in the city. We see substantial differences, but still the basic human psychology is there under both circumstances.
So the book is called The Age of Empathy. What for you is empathy? Is it charity? Is it generosity? Is it fairness?
That's altruism, and altruism is related to empathy. Empathy is that you are sensitive to the emotional state of somebody else and to the motor, let's say the motor patterns and the body language of somebody else. So, for example, you yawn and I yawn, and there's yawn contagion. That's a basic form of empathy, laugh contagion, feeling sad when you see someone who's crying. Those are very basic forms of empathy. And out of that can grow more complex forms where I'm not just affected by you, but I try to understand you and I try to figure out what's going on with you. And when something comes in where I want to help you, then we speak of sympathy. Sympathy is something else than empathy. And sympathy has this more like an action component. I want to do something about your situation. Now, sympathy may lead to compassion. And so compassion, sympathy, they are related to empathy, but they're not exactly the same.
Now, you've recorded many instances of ape empathy. What's telling in what you've seen?
Well, I'm particularly interested in the complex forms, and so although in the book I go over all the basic forms as well, even empathy in mice and in dogs and cats, whatever, I'm particularly interested in the complex forms where animals show an understanding of the situation of somebody else. And only a few animals do that, like apes do it, the dolphins, elephants, and of course humans, after a certain age, because interestingly, when humans are very young, a two-year-old child doesn't have the complex empathy that you would expect in a human. So that still has to develop. So to give an example of complex empathy, in a chimpanzee colony at a zoo in Sweden, there was a young chimpanzee who got a rope around its neck and it was choking, and it would die if no one did something. But the highest-ranking male went over to the juvenile and picked him up, so it took the pressure off the rope by picking him up with one arm. And with his other hand, which was free, he unwrapped the rope carefully from the neck, and then he put down the juvenile. It's a very interesting response because, first of all, he's interested in helping, which is the empathy response right there. But second, there's an intelligence to it. He could also have been pulling at the juvenile, which would have been a stupid thing to do because he would have killed it. But he lifted it up and unwrapped the rope. And that's what I call targeted helping responses. And you see those in some animals. But they're actually unusual in the animal kingdom. And those kind of helping responses show you a sort of empathy that you're going to find in humans also.
You mentioned earlier yawning and the sort, babies crying, for example. Do you see that in chimpanzees, that if someone's crying, and not necessarily crying, but doing something like that, expressing themselves emotionally, that another one would do the same?
Yeah, you see that sometimes. So, for example, when a female travels through the forest with her offspring and the offspring starts whimpering in the tree at a distance because it cannot cross the gap between the trees, then sometimes the mother will also whimper, make sort of like cry because then she hears her juvenile cry. And then, of course, her response is usually to go back and to bridge between the two trees and hang between the two trees so that the juvenile can travel from the one to the other. So yes, you see, for example, yawn contagion is something we can actually study because the other responses are harder to experiment with, but yawning we can actually do, and we've recently conducted a study where we created a yawning head, an animation, so it looks like a cartoon, and you see the cartoon yawning, and then a chimpanzee is watching it on a computer screen, and the chimpanzees start yawning too when they see that. So just like humans, they have yawn contagion, and yawn contagion is very much related to empathy, actually.
And it's not just mimicking, right?
No, it's not a conscious mimicking, because they do a real yawn. They really yawn with closed eye and everything, just like humans. So in humans also, it's not mimicking. If you present humans with yawns on TV or in a room, even if I start yawning in a room, you start yawning too, that's not mimicking. That is actually that you are emotionally affected by it.
In your experience, have you seen primates, chimpanzees and the sort, have you seen instances of greed, psychopathic or sociopathic behavior?
Well, we did one time a study where we asked animal caretakers about the personality of chimpanzees, and they would rate every individual that they knew. And in that study, a psychologist who studies psychopathy discovered the psychopathic dimension, which is psychopathy in humans is characterized by being unempathic. Basically, you exploit others to get things from them, but you're not interested in the feelings of others. So in chimpanzees, this must happen, but just as in humans, probably it's very hard to find a psychopath, because in humans, it's what only 1% or 2% of the population is classified as a psychopath. So you need a lot of chimpanzees, and we don't have so many, to going to find a few of those.
Are chimpanzees endangered?
In the field, they are, yes, for sure. The ape population, all of them, so orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, bonobos, all of them are in areas in the world where the forest is disappearing, and when the forest disappears, they are disappearing. The problem is that, for example, chimpanzees, there may be between 100 and 200,000 chimpanzees left, and that sounds maybe good to you, but we have 6 billion people, and the population keeps growing, and so there's really no competition. They cannot hold up against the population growth that humans are having.
And is there research being done to prevent, say, extinction?
Well, research is not sufficient. Of course, there are studies to see how best to protect them and how best to protect the forest, but research is not sufficient if the forest disappears. Research cannot accomplish this. What needs to happen is that very large parts of the forest are set aside for them, and that maybe human populations may use the forest, but in a way that is compatible with survival of a lot of these animals.
Is there a difference amongst male and female primates as to how empathetic they are?
Yeah, because I think the origin of empathy in the mammalian line is maternal care. And so a female needs to respond right away to the emotions of her offspring. Any female mammal needs. If her offspring are cold or hungry or distressed or in danger, she needs to get up and get something going, because otherwise she's going to lose her offspring. And so there's a very high survival value, as we biologists call it. There's a very high selection pressure on empathy in females towards their own offspring. And that's how I think empathy got started, and that probably also explains the difference we see between females and males in the degree of empathy that they have.
In the book, you tell this anecdote about the Chinese sage Mencius. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the king sees an ox being taken away to be sacrificed for some festival of something, mm-hmm, of some sort, and he sees the look of terror on the ox's face, and he feels bad, and so he spares the ox's life and instead sacrifices a sheep. Now, is his behavior empathetic? I mean, Mencius says not.
Well, Mencius was not impressed by the king, because the king had seen the ox and was emotionally affected by the ox, and that's why he saved the ox, but then he declared that they could use the sheep, and the sheep he hadn't seen yet. And so Mencius says, well, that means that you're only affected by what you see, because you had seen the ox. And so he was not impressed, because he felt that the king should have the level of imagination to imagine that the sheep would also not feel particularly good about this thing. So it's a sort of funny story, but it's interesting that Mencius already, this is 2,000 years ago, when we didn't speak of empathy, and he doesn't use the word empathy or sympathy in any way, but that already 2,000 years ago, people were sort of puzzled by how these things work and where they come from. And Mencius was a big believer that humans naturally incline to the good, which is, of course, quite opposite to what many people believe, but that's what he believed.
Now, who would be responsible for propagating that myth that we're in a dog-eat-dog world, that it's, you know, this is survival of the fittest? I mean, do we lay that on Darwin, perhaps?
No, not Darwin. Darwin himself actually was a believer in animal sympathy, and he was not in agreement with Herb Spencer, who introduced the survival of the fittest metaphor. And not only that, who said that that's how society also works. So Spencer was a contemporary of Darwin. He said that since in nature there is this dog-eat-dog world, we need to mimic that in society. And America especially, people were very sensitive to that message, and American society is based on competitive principles. And, of course, a year ago, when the stock market collapsed, this whole system came tumbling down, and we saw that you cannot base a society purely on competition and greed. It's not that you need to abolish the capitalist system. I'm not saying that. I think it's probably a very good economic system. But you need things in addition that balance it out. And Spencer is responsible for introducing this idea that nature works this particular way, and we need to mimic that in society. And what I'm saying in the book is that I don't think nature works that way. Nature, yes, evolution works by elimination, and that's, of course, a harsh, merciless process, but it has created animals like primates, like elephants, like dolphins, like humans, that are inherently social and cooperative. And so if we build a society, we need to take that into account, that we are actually a very cooperative species.
So let's take the fallout from the economic crisis. How would you bring empathy to the business world?
Oh, I'm not sure that I have ready solutions for the business world, but I do think, for example, social responsibility should be present in business leaders. Business leaders sometimes have been taught, like people like Alan Greenspan, who is a believer in Ayn Rand, people like that, they would teach business that basically their main responsibility is to make money for their shareholders. Now, I think business leaders have other responsibilities. In addition, they have responsibilities to their employees, for example. The employees are basically powerless in this game. And so they have a responsibility to the employees, to the community in which they are established. And so they have ethical obligations, for sure. So they should play honestly. And this is sometimes forgotten. It's not just about money. It's also about people that business should be concerned about.
So let's consider politics as well. Are you seeing that on a large scale, empathy coming into our governments, perhaps, in your country, in the United States, and in mine, maybe?
Well, empathy has, of course, always been part of politics. For example, the abolishment of slavery, the civil rights movement, the healthcare debate that we have currently, empathy is an important factor. I think empathy has always been part of politics, and maybe it needs to be a more prominent part. For example, Lincoln, when he abolished slavery, he was partly fed by memories that he had of seeing shackled slaves. He had seen slaves in the South, and he was very unhappy by that memory. And he wrote to friends that it haunted him to think about how these people lived, and he felt it was not fair, and he felt something needed to be done about it. Now, that's an empathic reaction right there that led to a major political shift and a political change in the United States. And I think empathy and fellow feeling have always been part of politics, and maybe in the last 30 years it has been downplayed because Reagan and Thatcher were not big fans of it, and they felt that everything could be regulated by the market. But I think we're returning to a time where people feel that empathy and solidarity need to be part of the equation.
So for people like myself, or for people listening, it's not just we have to feel empathetic. We have to do something with that empathy, right?
Yeah, we have to use it for constructive purposes and not suppress it. It's not a good thing, I think, to tell business leaders that all they need to do is make money. You need to tell them, yes, you can make money and make as much money as you want, but you have the following responsibilities within society.
So at the end of the day, after all your research, after writing this book, are you hopeful?
Oh, I'm an optimist by nature, and I've studied for a long time these positive tendencies in animals close to us, I must say, I'm not rosy-colored. I don't have rosy-colored glasses in the sense that I think that there's no aggression and competition, because I started with the power struggles at the Arnhem Zoo, and I started with aggression and competition. So I know that there's plenty of that in nature, and that nature is not all peace and harmony, for sure. But societies hang together by this kind of mechanisms, and so primate societies are quite cohesive, human societies are quite cohesive, and that's only possible because the members of the society have some interest in each other.
Say, you've been around chimpanzees and the sort through your work. When one dies, is there mourning that goes on amongst the other chimps?
Yeah, they're very seriously affected by it. Now, of course, if it is a young chimpanzee, the one who is most affected is obviously the mother, and a female who loses her offspring will go into mourning and basically a depression. She will not eat for weeks, and she will cry on occasion, sit in a corner and not show her face. But also the larger community, if a member dies, they're very much affected by that. And for example, they may not eat for a couple of days, and they may hang around the place where it happened. And yes, they're very much affected by it.
Do they console each other like we do when a relative dies?
Yeah, in that sense, they are quite different from monkeys. So for monkeys, we know that there is no such reaction. And actually, this has been studied in the field, in baboons, where baboons are being under predation from lions and hyenas. And so when a baboon is captured and eaten, then the family members really don't receive any consolation from the rest of the troop. They may seek contact with the rest, but they don't spontaneously receive much from them. In chimpanzees, it's quite different, because chimpanzees, as far as I know, in our case, for example, when a member dies, or when we remove a chimpanzee to move to another part, and so in our colony, all of a sudden, an individual has disappeared, under those circumstances, the ones who are left behind receive an enormous amount of grooming from the rest of the colony, as if they sense that there's something wrong and that they have a loss. And so they do react to these things.
And the sketches in the book, you did those yourself, right?
Yes.
Have you always drawn?
I've always drawn. And as a child, I had drawing lessons. And, yeah, I've always been attracted to art.
It seems that you enjoyed, this is just from reading the book and looking at the sketches, that you enjoy that as much as anything else, as much as the writing, perhaps.
I'm not sure, but I could have been an artist, I suppose, if I had chosen a totally different career, yes.
Yeah. Professor DeWall, this has been just a fascinating conversation. It's a marvelous book, a fascinating book as well. Thanks for talking to us today. Congratulations on the book. Continued good luck with it.
Yep, you're welcome.
The book is called The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. It's published by McClelland and Stewart. You can see Professor DeWall's website on the Emory website, emory.edu. Franz DeWall on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.